From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
The prohibition of torture and ill-treatment has been severely undermined by policies and practices in areas such as counterterrorism or extraordinary renditions or irregular migrations.
That was the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture, Niles Meltzer, discussing the case of missing Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, referring to the practices employed mostly by the U.S. since September 11, 2011.
Policies that are perceived to bring short-term benefits, but actually are implemented at the cost of seriously weakening the protection of human rights and the rule of law, and even public security and safety in the long run.
The UN Special Rapporteur said it was up to the governments of Saudi Arabia and Turkey to resolve the situation over Khashoggi's death, and that if they failed to do so, perhaps then it might be appropriate for outsiders to get involved in the case.
If no solution can be found in conducting a credible and objective investigation on that level, then perhaps at some point international mechanisms should get involved. I think we're a little bit early in the process to come to a definite conclusion there, because obviously this is a very delicate issue. And I think we should give the involved states time under public scrutiny to come to a conclusion that they want to address this problem.
Meanwhile, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo met Tuesday with Saudi Arabia's King Salman over the disappearance and apparent slaying of the Saudi writer, who vanished 2 weeks ago after entering the Saudi consulate in Istanbul for some documents pertaining to his then-pending marriage. Earlier this week, President Donald Trump spoke with the King of Saudi Arabia, who denied any involvement in the disappearance of Khashoggi. The president said the following to Fox Business Network's Trish Reagan.
Number one, what happened, but whether or not they knew about it. If they knew about it, that would be bad. If they didn't know about it, bad things can happen. But we're going to learn a lot about it. Now, one thing I have to say, they made the largest order in the history of our country for outside of our country, mm-hmm. For weapons, for any kinds of military weapons, mm-hmm. missile systems, ships, they're buying.
From us.
From us. $110 billion they're purchasing. It's 500,000 jobs, American jobs. Everything's made here. Okay, so now people say, well, we want to have you end that order. Well, aren't we just hurting our own country? Because here's what's going to happen. They're going to say, hey, America won't sell us the missiles. We'll buy them from China or we'll buy them from Russia. Ours are better, much better. They'll say America won't sell us the ships. America won't sell us the arms that we need. What we'll do is we'll buy them from Russia, China, and there are some others, France. You know, there are.
And
some
so they benefit financially, and they might then have a more strategic relationship, too, with those countries.
You have senators and congressmen say, oh, if they did that, we should punish them by not selling them equipment. Well, if we don't sell them the equipment, they'll buy lesser quality equipment because we make it's so much better than anybody else. But they'll buy it from Russia, they'll buy it from China. So we're not really hurting them, we're hurting ourselves. So we want to be smart. I don't want to give up a $110 billion order or whatever it is. It's the largest order ever given by an outside country, okay? And I don't want to give that up. You're talking about jobs. What I'm doing here, we've created an incredible economy. I want Boeing and I want Lockheed and I want Raytheon to take those orders and to hire lots of people to make that incredible equipment.
Well,
you understand.
You know, yeah, no, I get it, but it's complicated stuff. And, you know, you're looking at jobs here at home and a lot of money for American companies versus what certainly seems is pretty atrocious. Now we don't know everything, but
we don't know.
I mean these are the decisions that you face as president.
Let's hope we hear the proper answers.
Last week's spectacular save of the Soyuz disaster brought news with it of previous Russian successes in the midst of failure. Despite the failure of the boosters, the Russian and American aboard Soyuz did not die and were hardly injured. But you can hear that in their own words. This is RT journalist Igor Zhdanov speaking with Russian cosmonaut Alexei Ovchinin in an exclusive interview with RT And that's followed with an RT interview with NASA astronaut Nick Hague.
Well, Rory, indeed, we do have a very special guest. I do have a very special guest here with me in the studio. Alexei Avchinin, one of the two persons on board of that Soyuz rocket that was supposed to head into orbit, well, on Thursday, but that didn't happen. There was a rocket failure, so the crew had to make an emergency landing some 700 kilometers or so away from the Baikonur Cosmodrome. And I have, as I've said, Alexei Avchinin right here with me. Just to warn you, I will be speaking in Russian. The interview will be in Russian, but of course we do have a translator standing by for you. So we can now begin, I think. So, Alexei Nikolaevich,
Alexei, thank you so much for joining us today. So what was happening aboard the Soyuz when the launch went wrong?
Well, the situation became an emergency. We noticed it by the emergency signals blinking, and we instantly realized what had happened. And from then on, it was the automatics of the spacecraft, and we were doubling its activities as the crew.
So we started getting the first pictures when we had the live broadcast during the launch. We had a moment when we saw that the capsule you were in was shaking heavily, and the signal was there was a disruption in the signal. Was this exactly the time when you realized, or was it something nominal at that stage?
When everything goes according to plan, when the first stage is detached, there's always this kind of vibration that you can see on video images. That's normal. But after the first stage detached, we felt vibrations continue, and then immediately there was the emergency signal going off, and we realized that this was an emergency.
So when that system went off, and when you saw the lights blinking, indicating there was a failure, it's your second flight. So what was the first thought that came to your mind? So you know you've trained for 10 years, so you've been prepared for it, but what was the first thing that came to your mind? What was the first idea?
Well, once we had the emergency signal, we realized that this flight will have to be aborted, and that will have to go down by a ballistic trajectory.
Well, you said that it was all done automated, and you just kept track of what was happening. So you were the commander of the pair. What depends on you?
Like I said, after the emergency was signaled, the emergency rescue system automatically switched on, and depending on which stage of the launch the emergency happens, and there are three stages all in all, the emergency rescue system works according to a certain algorithm. At the moment of the emergency, during our liftoff, the main the main mast carrying the carrier rocket, it had been detached already, but the boosters were still there, which continued to work after the emergency. And after the pod separated, and there was the emergency separation from the boosters, then the various parts of the module separated from each other, and then the cyclogram went in, and the pods went into a landing according to a ballistic trajectory. The crew controls this signal system, and we have a handle called Ruse, which we have to use to give certain commands to double the activities of the automatic emergency system, and that's what we were doing in accordance with the drills, and everything went in accordance with the contingency plans. So there was this ballistic trajectory landing on a parachute detachment, and then we prepared for landing.
Well, for Nick Hague, this was his maiden flight. Did you discuss it with him? I mean, not just the technical and professional discussion. Did you discuss it from a personal point of view?
I must say that Nick did very well throughout our flight, which lasted a little over 19 minutes, from liftoff to landing. At all stages, he was engaged, he was supportive, he was helping me, he was responding to conversations from Earth, from the ground station. And after we landed and we were recovered by the search and rescue team, I didn't see him either frightened, so he did very well. He acted in a professional way, and I believe our crew was tightly knit and working well together, and I would like very much to take my next flight with Nick.
Well, you said 19 minutes, slightly more than 19 minutes. Okay. How much time did you spend in that recovery capsule, and what did you do during that ballistic reentry?
Exactly all of those 19 minutes, and sometime after landing, we were inside the landing pod until the search and rescue team who parachuted down to get us out, they landed next to the pod, and they helped us out of the pod. They also worked very quickly, very professionally. After we landed, I called the search and rescue aircraft and then the search and rescue helicopter. We established radio communication with them, and we were permanently in touch, and so we had a good idea who would be doing what.
Well, you've been trained to endure 6-7G, if I understand.
A little under 7G.
So what kind of feelings do you have? What do you experience? Can you share it with us so that an untrained personnel alignment would understand what is all about? What can you compare it with?
Well, you could compare it. First of all, it can work in various directions. The gravity forces can go in various directions. The crew who are in their special seats, usually you feel the pressure with your chest and your back. When there is increased gravity, you could compare it with a block of concrete being put on your chest, and then with 7G, its weight would be 7 times your weight. So take your weight and multiply it by 7. If you weigh 90 kilos, you would weigh 7 times as much, and you would have that weight of concrete lying on your chest.
Well, it sounds it's incredibly huge.
It is actually bearable. When you train and when you pass medical tests, we train on a centrifuge, and it has a standard pressure of 8G. So crew members usually have an idea of what it's going to feel like, how you're supposed to breathe in such a situation, what you're supposed to do. So this wasn't the first time for us, and we were ready.
RT, together with Roscosmos, did a TV show called Start. It's a 40-minute program sharing exciting stories, telling the audience about the launch. Thank you for taking part in it. You responded to some of our questions, and there were stupid questions, I must admit, but there was a question, are you afraid to fly? And you said you're not afraid to fly, but you're afraid when you do not fly. Do you still think the same?
Yes, my opinion has not changed the way I feel about it. After landing, Nick and myself, we feel fine. We have passed medical tests, not once actually, several times, and the medics agree that we are fine physically. As for our mental state, we are ready to continue. space flights, and so after there's been an explanation of what actually happened, I'm hoping that we will take a flight in the nearest time. We would like that very much.
Talking of psychology, this was a heavy test for you and for your family. We talked to Svetlana, your spouse, who was in Star City at that moment. What do they think about your future flights? It's impossible to get prepared for such a phenomenal situation like the one happened on Thursday.
Well, my family members, after they have been through this situation, next time it will be more difficult for them to let me go, to let me take such a space flight, because obviously they've been scared. But on the other hand, they are confident in our equipment, in the way we're in our training, in what we're prepared for. Anything can happen. This is hardware we're talking about, but we are prepared, and this is our job. We cannot stop at what we've done. We need to move on.
Your mother met you at Baikonur when you landed. What was the first thing you told her when she told you?
I told her not to worry. I said I was okay. I said my health was in good condition. I said, look at me, I'm walking. Nothing is broken, so don't be frightened. And after she saw me with her own eyes, she calmed down. So that's how it was.
What about your wife?
With my wife, I called her almost immediately after landing. We had a satellite phone in our pod specifically for cases like that, for situations like that. And after we were recovered from the pod, we took out the satellite phone. I immediately called our superiors. I told them that we were alive and well. I told them our whereabouts. I told them that we had been recovered by the search and rescue team. And then I called my wife and told her that I was fine. She learned that there had been an emergency situation, but she had no specific information on, and I calmed her down. And after that, I called, and then our superiors also started calling our relatives to calm them down.
Staying on what you said first, I remember that you said it was a quick one. So did the sense of humor help you?
Well, I wouldn't say there was any irony in this. It was more humor, somewhat laced with pity, because we realized that our mission had to be aborted and our space flight would not be going on. We had spent 18 months with Nick training for this flight, and this would have been his first space flight. It was second for me, and I remembered how you prepare for your first space mission and the feelings that you have. So some things that you have to feel yourself. When you hear about it from someone else, it's not enough. I'm hoping that we will try it once again, and we'll get all those positive emotions that we were supposed to get.
Now, from the statements by Roscosmos, next spring in April, we will have next flights where you will fly with possibly Nick. You're an experienced one, and you've been training for this flight for 187 days. So will you spend it on training? How will you spend it? What will you do during that period?
I'm hoping that I will spend fewer than 187 days down here on Earth. As soon as we start, as soon as we're done analyzing the emergency situation, the dates for further launches will be identified, and as soon as that happens, we'll start preparing for our next space flight, and it'll be clear by that time what kind of training, what kind of preparation we'll have to undergo. Of course, we immediately will start training in order to be prepared prepared by the time we need to launch and to be in an even better shape.
Going back to the emergency safety system, it worked flawlessly. And again, this was the first incident in more than 30 years. So how would you assess the performance of the system and the search and rescue systems too?
First of all, I'd like to thank the designers, the constructors, the architects of our space craft, all those people involved in the preparations of the space mission, and all the medics who were involved in the rescue mission, the space and the search and rescue team, the medics who saw to us after we had been recovered. Like you said, for 35 years there haven't been such an emergency, but this did not play a role because the people involved in the search and rescue, they acted very swiftly and professionally, and I have nothing but thanks for them. And for my part, myself personally and other people, we have been reaffirmed in our confidence that our hardware works and that we shouldn't be afraid, that when need be, our hardware will work properly.
Did you get in contact with the ISS? Did you talk to Sergei, who is up there? So we've been talking to him. He was waiting for you just before the launch. He said that they've been really waiting for you. He even made a meal for you. Did you talk to him?
We did get in touch. Sergei called, and we had a conversation. I told him I was all right, that my health was well. He was sorry that we hadn't made it to the ISS because we were carrying presents for the crew of the station. But it was also interesting because the guys were taking pictures of our liftoff from the ISS, and they actually managed to capture the moment of the emergency of the abortion of our flight. So it was interesting to saw those. I hope that the next crew will be going to the ISS as soon as possible, and the ISS program, the experiments, the scientific work, and the activities to keep the station operational will continue.
The Russian Space Agency said they might push the date of the next launch earlier to early December. Thank you so much, Mr. Avchinin, for sitting down with us and sharing how it all happened. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
That was RT's journalist Igor Zhdanov speaking with Russian cosmonaut Alexei Avchinin about his adventure last week after the failure of a rocket that was intended to lift him and his American partner Nick Haig from NASA to the International Space Station. This was Nick Haig speaking about that same event.
You know, the first 2 minutes of the launch were going great. Everything was nominal, and it was right after the first staging when the booster started to separate inside. It went from normal to something was wrong pretty quick. The automated system pulled us away from the rocket so fast, and so the first thing I really noticed was being shaken fairly violently side to side as that safety system pulled us away from the rocket. And then there was an alarm inside the capsule and a light that was up there, and you know, I knew once I saw that light that we had an emergency with the booster, that at that point we weren't going to make it to orbit that day. So the mission changed to getting back down on the ground as safely as we could. The first frame or two before the feed cuts from the capsule of us being shaken side to side, you know, it continued for a little while after that before it settled out, and then it was kind of a slow coasting ride to the top of our ballistic trajectory. So there were a couple things that happened at the top. I got to experience a few seconds of weightlessness, and I was able to watch a few things float around in the capsule. Our zero-G indicators that we had hanging with us were floating around. I was also able to look out the window, you know, primarily to make sure, hey, are we in a good attitude? Are we stable? Are we ready to come back down? But also look out the window and realize, you know, looking down at the curvature of the Earth and out into the blackness of space and realizing I got close, but it wasn't going to be this time. So everything was new for me. It was my first time. So I have to give kudos to my commander, Alexei Evchinin. He's a seasoned veteran cosmonaut. And as we were going through this, he was able to tell me, you know, what was normal, what was not normal. Obviously, a ballistic descent, we come up and we're coming back down in a fairly steep trajectory. And to lose all of that energy, it all ends up being absorbed as wind resistance and G. And so the G's built up pretty fast. Luckily, we didn't have the 6 to 7 G's for very long. It was only a handful of seconds, and then things were back down to normal. From that point, after that peak of G, it's a normal Soyuz landing. And so everything went nominal from that point on. So I've been in the centrifuge. I've felt what 6, 7 G's feels like. They take us all the way up to 8 G's when we're doing the training. Then, you know, the other aspect is we are in a capsule that looks just like the real thing. It's actually old parts that they've scavenged from previous vehicles. And so when you're sitting in there and the simulations and the emergencies are going off and the alarms are sounding and you're making all the switch throws, it feels just like you're there. And that was one of the comments I had to Alexei when we were sitting there before launch, is this feels just like the simulator. So it's a very comfortable feeling because you've spent so many hours inside there. You know where every switch is at by memory. You really don't have to look to be able to find what you're after. We looked at each other. We had grins from ears to ears. You can imagine the scene. We're in the capsule. We're kind of hanging upside down from our straps because of the orientation of the capsule. And we look at each other, big grins. He holds out a hand. I shake his hand. And then we start cracking a few jokes between us about how short our flight was. Funny story, we're sitting there next to the capsule after we've landed, and we're trying to make all the phone calls on our satellite phone that we're supposed to make, and then after that we start trying to get in touch with loved ones. So after Alexei was able to speak with his wife, I called mine, and unfortunately it went to voicemail. So now she has she's got a voicemail that she can keep as a memento for the rest of her life. I imagined that my first trip to outer space was going to be a memorable one. I didn't expect it to be quite this memorable. But it's what we do is hard. And it's not something that I think you can state enough. What do we mean when we say space is hard? Human exploration of space is hard. There's risk, and we do everything we can to mitigate that risk. But there's always some risk there. The designers, the engineers, the people that build these spacecraft, they're constantly trying to make the perfect spacecraft. But it can't be perfect all the time. So we have contingencies in place, and we have other fail-safe systems. And this was just a great example of those fail-safe systems stepping in and doing their job. We hadn't had to use those on the Soyuz in 35 years, and it was still ready to go when it was needed. And so for that, I'm very thankful for all those people that invested so much in making sure that those fail-safe systems are in place. So I'm not concerned with the Soyuz. Obviously, I'm very interested in what's developing with commercial crew and getting that there. And I've mentioned that before in previous interviews. It provides us as a program with a robust means to get astronauts and cosmonauts to the space station so that if we have a problem with one vehicle, we can still deliver on time and not have to do the types of things that we might need to do if we've got delays with one particular vehicle. So I'm excited to see that progress continue, but I'm also very confident in the Soyuz to be able to continue to deliver crew members to the station. So we actually had to stay in a hospital in Baikonur overnight for observation. And I'm laying there in the hospital bed, and I get a phone call from Alex and Serena on board. And they were giving me a hard time, saying that they were eating my dinner that they had prepared for me and had waiting for me. But we joked around a little bit, and they're in a situation up there that they didn't expect to be in, being up there short a few crewmates. And it's going to make life more challenging for them over the next few months. But there's a team on the ground of thousands that are making it possible and arranging things to give them the support that they need. So they're going to be great.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.